Talks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. North Carolina has been blessed with diversity. Mountains, beaches, big cities, small towns, farms, everything in between. We've also been blessed by an abundance of water, which we use to sustain life. We use it for recreation. We use it for power generation. But keeping those waterways healthy isn't always easy. And taking up that challenge, at least along our major rivers, are the river keepers. And today we have three of them from very different rivers in different parts of the state to talk about how they tackle those challenges, what's at stake, and what their goals are going forward. Sam Perkins is back with us. He's the river keeper for the Catawba River Keeper Foundation, our river. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Hartwell Carson has served as the French Broad River Keeper for the last 6 years. The French Broad runs through the Asheville area. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's good to see you because you went to the wrong studio, but now here you are.
You didn't have to tell everybody.
I'm kind of perverse and mean that way, but you made it in the nick of time. And Kemp Burdett works near the coast as the Cape Fear River Keeper, and I want to thank you, the two of you who came from Asheville and Wilmington, for coming here, converging on us here today. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Riverkeepers are not part of the government. They are not officially designated by any governmental organization at any level, I don't think. You're all independent. You work for the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation, as I said, Sam. So when did riverkeepers come into existence? When did this all start? Because I don't remember us talking about this in the 1970s even.
There have always been a lot of groups really around the world, but throughout the past 40 years that really started working on water issues, especially after the Clean Water Act in 1972. And so coming in through the late 90s, a lot of those groups decided to start a network known as Waterkeeper Alliance, and that's grown through the 2000s. And now we have more than 200 Waterkeeper Alliance members in the world. There's a Tigris and Euphrates Riverkeeper in Iraq. So
they have their job cut out for them.
They certainly do, actually.
The story I was told was there was a group of fishermen on the Hudson River, and they were appalled at the state of the Hudson River. The fish tasted like diesel fuel, and they wanted to do something about it. And these were salt of the earth, World War II veteran types, and they got in a room, and one guy started talking about floating a mattress full of dynamite into the intake of this power plant. Another guy said they should jam the waste of this one factory and flood them with their own waste. And finally, a guy stood up and he said, you know, we don't need to talk about breaking the law. We need to be talking about enforcing the law. And so that was the model that was established on the Hudson River with the Hudson River Keeper, and it was very effective. And soon other folks said, you know, we want a river keeper. We want somebody that speaks for our waterway and will stand up and protect water quality.
So when did the French Broad River get their first river keeper?
We had about 12 years ago, I think, and I've been the riverkeeper for a little over 8 years now. Okay. And so we were fairly early on. I think Catawba was before that, and I'm not sure when the Cape Fear came online.
We'll ask.
Yeah, so the Cape Fear Riverkeeper started in 1994, so this is our 20th year this year. And, you know, I'll add, I think North Carolina is fortunate. We've got, we're one of the states that probably has more river keepers than a lot of other states, 9 river keeper programs in North Carolina. So pretty much covering the state pretty well.
Kemp, you have a degree, if I'm not mistaken, in geology mm-hmm. and a master's in public administration. Hartwell, you've worked for the Forest Service in your past life, and you're president also of the Tennessee River Keeper. We'll talk about how that's possible. And you were a journalist, Sam, prior to your becoming
trying to hedge my bets in a geochemistry lab also, yeah.
So how did people with such various backgrounds, what did those backgrounds do to prepare you to do what you do now?
I would say nothing.
Honesty.
I think this is like a lot of jobs in that nothing prepares you for it except for doing it. You know, my dad went to law school and he said he didn't learn anything about being a lawyer in law school. And I think that's the same. You know, you get on the job, you figure out your community, you figure out the problems on your river, and then you figure out the tools that are in the toolbox to address them.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of the tools we utilize are supposed to be part of the public process. They're supposed to be accessible to everyone. And so a lot of what we do is help people understand what options there are to, challenge permits or really get their environment and their waterways improved. So it is a learning process that you don't necessarily learn in school for what's just part of the public infrastructure.
So how are you guys funded? How are your specific organizations funded? Who tells you what to do? Who tells you what the priorities ought to be? If you come from these different backgrounds like journalism, et cetera, how do you know what makes for a healthy river, et cetera?
Our members, volunteers, people in the community, they let us know what's important to them. So we're all 501c3 nonprofits, and we have membership bases, and there are a lot of concerned people who want to do something and aren't sure quite how to do that. And so they really help us dictate what our priorities are going to be.
Do you find that government organizations listen to you? Does Diener listen to you in North Carolina?
I think they do. I think you know, sometimes more than others, but I think that all of our organizations have built a pretty good reputation as being, you know, pretty solid places to go when you need some answers about the river and how we can work together to protect it. So
place your rivers as we talk about this, because people may be new to the state that are listening to us. So, Kemp, let's place the Cape Fear River exactly where it runs and what kind of topography it runs through.
So the Cape Fear is North Carolina's largest watershed, contained completely within the state. It runs kind of northwest from Wilmington all the way up to around Greensboro. Mm-hmm. Major tributaries are the Deep and the Hall that come together to form the main stem of the river, and the Black River, which drains out of Sampson County area, and the Northeast Cape Fear River that drains down from just south of Onslow County, all kind of come together right at Wilmington, and there's a very large estuary, about a 30-mile-long estuary that empties into the Atlantic right near Baldhead Island.
And what about the French Broad? We know it's in Asheville or near Asheville or runs through Asheville.
Well, we're lucky because the French Broad is obviously the most beautiful river in North Carolina. we actually are really lucky in that it flows off the mountains in North Carolina. So we start with really clean, beautiful trout waters. You know, there's a lot of whitewater. You know, the North Fork of the French Broad River is a beautiful trout fishery, class 5 whitewater, flows together. The West Fork and the North Fork come together. And so a lot of, you know, we all live downstream is the motto, but in Asheville, or, you know, on the French Broad starts, you know, we're really creating the only pollution that's in the French Broad is what we put into the French Broad in the watershed. So that's nice and beneficial. But the folks downstream, it flows north, which is interesting, flows through Hendersonville and Asheville and into Tennessee, through the Pisgah National Forest. But the folks downstream in Knoxville, where it forms the French Broad and the Holston form the Tennessee River, are dealing with all of our pollution. They pull their drinking water directly out of the French Broad River.
Is that why you are the president of the Tennessee Riverkeeper Association too?
Well, mostly just because it was a group that was forming and they wanted some help from riverkeepers that had experience and, you know, knowledge about the issues that they were dealing with. So even though, you know, our jurisdiction's not technically there, it's sort of just an aside as a fellow riverkeeper group we're trying to help.
So you just said that because you're near the headwaters of the French Broad, you have the most pristine all the pollution that's in that, if there's pollution in it, is because of the things that are being added by people and industry right there on the banks, because it's pristine where it starts. Does that follow then that the Cape Fear River is the dirtiest because it's all the way downstream as it enters the ocean?
That is the joke we like to make.
No, you know, the Cape Fear is it's a very different river than the French Broad. You know, we are a lot of the rivers in the coastal plain, we've got blackwater streams that are flowing in, and so, you know, it's a very different river, and there are parts of the Cape Fear River Basin that are also pristine.
Okay.
We have a lot of impacts from a lot of different industries and you know, municipalities up and down the waterway, but, you know, certainly a beautiful river in our own right. Some really amazing wildlife and some of the highest levels of biodiversity, you know, on the eastern seaboard or in the kind of lower Cape Fear River Basin.
And Sam, you run the Catawba. It does exactly what you tell it to do. our hometown river, place that for us, for people who may have just moved here.
It's interesting. It starts on the other side of the ridge line from the French Broad, and it's a neat contrast. It starts east of Asheville, near the town of Old Fort, Black Mountain, and runs east for a while and then cuts south down toward Columbia, South Carolina. And we're unique in that we're pretty much a series of linked impoundments, lakes. We have 11 of them in the Catawba. There are only a few free-flowing sections, really the headwaters and a couple in the middle.
And those lakes would be Lake Norman, Lake Wiley, Mountain Island Lake, name a couple of others.
Yeah, Lake James, Lake Rodus, Lake Hickory, Lookout Shoals, Norman, Mountain Island, Wiley, and then you've got a few smaller ones in South Carolina, and then finally Lake Watery.
Okay.
And we have people populated on those banks, and provides a lot of property tax base, but it also means a lot of those impacts build up very efficiently behind the dams. And so we have, you know, a lot of buildup of problems.
I was going to ask you, does the fact that we have so many lakes, artificially introduced lakes along the system, does that provide specific challenges that the other two rivers don't have?
It does. There's both an ability to control floods and then also difficulty controlling floods. And the other thing that's unique, a lot of other organizations, other places in the country deal with the Army Corps of Engineers, and we deal with Duke Energy instead because they control all the dams throughout the Catawba Watery River Basin.
Now, during the drought, which we hope will never return, but we had a really long period of a very serious drought, and we did a lot of shows on this. This is many years ago. And people, not just within Duke Energy, but people outside of Duke Energy, talked about what a great corporate citizen they were for managing the water levels in those lakes, not only for electric power generation, but also for recreational purposes, because they got really low. The lake level started to drop precipitously. How would you characterize their stewardship of the dams and lakes?
Where we would like to see improvement, especially during drought time, is for a reduction in what they evaporate off from their power plants. Of all the water that's consumed, as in it leaves, it doesn't come back, it's not available downstream, half of it is consumed by the coal and nuclear power plants through their cooling water, which we also have one of the densest national arrangements of, with five power plants and a 39-mile span of the Catawba River. So we evaporate off a lot of water. I wish they would reduce some of that evaporative consumption. And there is a plan that is being worked on, and we would like to see more of that involved. But I think people responded very well in reducing their use, and they have continued since 2007. The people of Charlotte and the region have used a lot less water since that drought.
At a time when our population is growing, it's something else that challenges all three rivers, which I want to talk about. You grew up, Kemp, on the banks of the Cape Fear River, and you say that becoming the river keeper is a dream come true.
Yeah.
How so? Why?
Well, you know, it's special for me to be taking care of the river that I spent so much time on. You know, as a kid, you know, paddling and camping and goofing off with my friends. And so, you know, I've got two little girls now, and we get out on the river and do those same types of things, and I look forward to doing even more of that. So, you know, you asked earlier about, you know, how did my education, you know, prepare me to be a river keeper, and I think having a little bit of science background helps. But really, the fact that I grew up on that river gave me, you know, I think everything I needed to love my job and to be passionate about it and really care about that river. So,
is this something you ever thought you'd become, Sam, a river keeper?
You know, I think this is the ideal blend between sort of journalism and that research and also the hard science that I loved and trying to hedge those bets. So I couldn't have imagined this at all, but it is exactly what I wanted to do. I work with great people and volunteers throughout the basin. It's not the same thing every day. I love it.
Hartwell?
Well, if you wanted, I knew I loved outdoor things, and if you want to do something to protect those things, you basically had three options. You have air, trees, and water, and I decided water was the most fun of those three things. And so that's what I've spent my time doing, trying to protect the French Broad River that I grew up paddling, going to summer camp in Black Mountain, North Carolina, and it's been a, you know, rewarding job. When I first started, I thought, I want to be on the government side because you get to enforce the rules. But I realize if nobody's crying, you know, if nobody's, you know, making those rules important, then nothing happens.
When we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the challenges faced on all three rivers throughout the state. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC Charlotte Graduate School, offering graduate certificates from energy analytics to nonprofit management. Open houses held on campus and online. Details at gradcertificate.uncc.edu. Well, the stock market has been outperforming the economy for quite some time. It's been really, really soaring until quite recently. It seems that fears and jitters about the world situation are causing the market to decline. So should you be concerned? We're going to talk to two of the city's leading financial planners about that. But most importantly, we're going to talk about how kids should relate to money, what you can tell them about money, how they can learn to save money, eventually to invest that money, and how accumulation of that kind of knowledge, these conversations about money, might result in them being better off than you when they are older. And we'll talk about that Monday at 9.
Are you a member of WFAE? If not, consider making a financial commitment to help pay for the news you listen to every day right here on 90.7. Individual contributions make up more than 50% of our operating funds, and your support is needed today to help us continue to bring you all the programs you listen to each week. Join your friends and neighbors today and become more involved with your public radio station by going to WFAE.org and make a contribution.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to three of the state's river keepers. Sam Perkins is the Catawba River Keeper. Hartwell Carson is the French Broad River Keeper up near Asheville. And Kemp Burdett is the Cape Fear River Keeper down near the coast. Are there other river keepers in the state? Are you it?
There are a number of other river keepers in North Carolina.
Okay. I was going to ask you what you do when you go to work every day, but let's talk about the challenges that the three of you face and the three of the rivers that you are keepers for face, because you all serve as watchdogs. What are the principal threats facing your three rivers? Let's start upstream with the French Broad.
Yeah, I think, you know, the things we're focused mostly on the French Broad, and I think the long-term, you know, worry is population growth. You know, that has an impact in a variety of ways. You have, you know, concerns from sewage, which we deal with a lot on the French Broad, from human and animal waste. You also have sediment runoff, which is the number one polluter in the French Broad, even though it doesn't seem like that, you know, that concerning, it really does cause a detrimental impact on aquatic life. Clogs fish gills, warms the water, kills and smothers a lot of aquatic life. So population growth really, you know, exacerbates those problems. But we also have issues with coal ash and runoff from, you know, big factory-type farms. And so it's a host of things, which keeps it hard but also very interesting. You know, it's not the same thing every day.
Okay. You know, along the Catawba, Sam.
The biggest threat long-term is water quantity, because we have such a large population. More than 2 million people depend on the Catawba watery, and we have a very small surface area. If you look at it on a map, there's not a whole lot of drainage area, yet a lot of our water is sent to the east of us, to the Yadkin-Pedy, and it's not available downstream. So water quantity and the evaporative issues I spoke to earlier with power plants, that's really our biggest long-term issue. But, of course, coal ash. Mismanaged agriculture, nutrient loading. You know, nutrients are what fueled the large algal bloom in Toledo, Ohio, that produced the toxin and made them shut down their water supply for a while for 600,000 people. And so we don't have a whole lot of other options given how small our basin area is.
Okay, and along the Cape Fear, Kemp.
Yeah, we deal a lot with the same issues. You know, all three of us deal with issues related to these large industrial-scale farms, what you might hear called CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. We all deal with the impacts from coal ash and coal ash storage that's leaking into our waterways. On the Cape Fear, we deal with issues related to dams, different types of dams than what Sam deals with, but these are dams that are blocking migratory fish from getting to their traditional spawning grounds. So that's something we work on. And down closer to Wilmington, we've been fighting for 6 years now a proposed very large cement plant that would have huge impacts, a strip mine and coal burning kiln.
Now, all three of you have mentioned coal ash, and we will spend some time talking about coal ash and the problem that it presents for all three of these rivers. But before we get too deeply into that, I want to You mentioned off the air a second ago, Sam, that this has been the worst year for water in a long while, and we'll talk about why that is. But I also want to talk about why our river, the Catawba, which is where we get our drinking water from, it was designated as one of America's most endangered rivers, not once, but three times, number 13 in 2000, number 1 in 2008, number 5 in 2013.
And in 2008, it was because of the water quantity issues associated with the drought. We had pretty much run dry. And in last year, it was because of coal ash and the threats. And given that, you know, if we had a disaster like Dan River, we'd be in a huge crisis given the dense population in the area, especially around the drinking water reservoirs.
And you called this the worst year for water in a long while because of what?
You know, it's funny. VH1 has a show, Best Year Ever. This seemed fitting, worst year ever for water. We had the West Virginia chemical spill in January that affected 300,000 people and ultimately a lot more downstream. The Dan River disaster in February, and then the crisis in Toledo this past month when 600,000 people were affected. And it's one of those frustrating things where you kind of wonder, what is it going to take when you have event after event that's building up, not just in creating a lot of inconvenience and ultimately public health problems, but a lot of economic impacts. And when you have to have everything from a restaurant to a hotel to a salon shut down because they can't use the water, you would think that might start to resonate with people for the impact that has.
Has it resonated?
I think in North Carolina, it unfortunately has not to the extent that it should. We saw coal ash legislation after the Dan River disaster that we thought that might have been the final straw that would break the camel's back and get us some good coal ash regulations, and we didn't see that come out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about coal ash. It keeps coming up. We can't avoid it. Hartwell, your river is the site of what might be, and all three of your rivers face coal ash situations, but yours is the site of what might be the biggest fight over coal ash, I am told. You have a Duke Energy power plant, as we do, on the river. What has been the impact? What's the problem there with the coal ash for you?
Well, it's similar across the state. Unfortunately, it's not unique. I would like to say that, you know, the problems we see in Asheville are unique to Asheville, but they're not. We have groundwater contamination. We have contamination of people's drinking water wells, and we have
from coal ash,
and we have seeps from these dams. And seeps is a little misleading because Duke Energy's even said it's up to 1 million gallons a day of these pollutants illegally dumping into the French Broad River.
That's a seep.
Yeah, I know. That's why I don't like to use the term seep, but it's sort of like coal ash pond. It's really a big nasty hole in the ground. Pond's a little misleading also.
This has been going on for almost a century around the state because we have 33, I believe, coal ash ponds in the state. And many of them are unlined, and many of them were opened in the 1920s, 30s? Mm-hmm. They've been leaching. So over time, have there been any really bad effects because of the fact that they exist?
Well, certainly in Mountain Island Lake, here on the Catawba and Charlotte and Mount Holly and Gastonia's primary drinking water reservoir for more than 1 million people, we've seen a lot of arsenic build up in the soil. And there's been an issue for the municipalities dealing with that arsenic getting into the algae and sediment that they remove from the water. And
Has anybody gotten sick from it? Have we seen any significant aquatic life or animal die-off from this?
We have seen wells contaminated, and actually Hartwell and Kemp, I think, can speak to that maybe better than anyone else in the state.
And there's recently some of our fellow waterkeepers have been investigating the Bug Power Plant, and certainly the community there that's been drinking hexavalent chromium, the same stuff from Aaron Brockovich, and have been sickened over years, would certainly say that coal ash has had a long-term impact. You've also had, you know, big fish kills on the Cape Fear River.
Yeah, we've seen real natural resource impacts. Cooling pond for the power plant down near Wilmington, Sutton Power Plant, is seeing really high levels of selenium in the fish there, levels high enough to kill.
And where is that coming from?
That's coming from coal ash ponds, that sit right on the Cooling Pond Lake, which is a very popular fishing lake. I mean, hundreds and thousands of people fish there.
Talk about, because we use the word pond, and people see this little pond out in the backyard, or if you have a farm, maybe this big area, which is not so big when you come right down to it, size of a small parking lot. That's not what we're talking about here.
Not at all.
We're talking about, I don't like even the term ponds. I think lagoons, being in the South, I have to use a food comparison. It's like a pile of mashed potatoes holding back toxic gravy. It's piled up. You know, these are up to 130 feet high. They're tens or even hundreds of acres large. So they're vast, they're tall, but even as big as they are, they're relatively well hidden by trees. And so I think a lot of people have had a tough time understanding how propped up these are on our drinking water reservoirs.
And a lot of these are on the water line. I mean, they're right at the water
line. It's about the worst place they could be, yeah.
They're all on the water.
I mean, okay, well, then why is the question? Why?
Well, back in the day,
not to point fingers of blame, but somebody decided this.
Yeah, power plants needed water to cool the plant. That was the main reason. So you wanted to be located next to a lake or a river. So it made a lot of sense. And, you know, maybe, you know, 100 years ago, you could not lay blame at the idea that digging an unlined hole in the ground and throwing toxic waste wasn't a bad idea. But for a long time now, we've known that's not a great way to store toxic materials, yet Duke Energy's continued to do it and insist on continuing to do it into the future in a lot of these lagoons.
How many other companies do that?
Most of the big energy companies do that because it's expensive to change. And unless they're forced to do it by their state or by the federal government, they're not going to incur that kind of expense voluntarily.
We have to generate power using coal until we have some major breakthrough in other technology, or we won't be able to generate the kind of power that we require. So what would, in the best of all possible worlds, what would you have them do?
Well, it's not just what would we have them do, what have other utilities done? And in South Carolina, South Carolina Electric and Gas and Santee Cooper are both utilities that willingly, albeit with a little nudge from us in the Riverkeeper community, a legal nudge, they have agreed to move their sites away from water into a lined landfill.
But in terms of economies of scale,
SCE&G
and the other company you mentioned, how many people are they serving? How big are their operations in comparison to Duke Energy?
Well, it's easy to say that they're smaller because Duke Energy is the largest utility in the nation.
Which also means they have the most resources to do this right and
absolutely
should do it right even more than anyone else, including SCE&G.
Report just came out a couple of days ago. You know, they're making record profits right now. They're 80% up from last year, I think it said. You know, they certainly have the resources to do the right thing, and part of the reason they've done so well is because they haven't had to pay the cost of their production of energy, the full cost. They haven't done the right thing on cleaning
up. So when you have conversations about the problems your rivers face with regard to coal ash, who do you have those conversations with? Is it with Duke Energy or is it with the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources in North Carolina or others in the government?
We beat on everybody's door about the coal ash issue. I know you guys were the same way. You know, for years now, we've been going to Progress Energy previously, to Duke Energy, to the state, to the community, to our local elected officials, to try and get anyone to listen. And unfortunately, no one would do anything about it until legal actions were filed. And that finally got the attention of the state and Duke Energy. And we're seeing some progress now. They've verbally committed to cleaning up most of the plants that we're dealing with in our area. That hadn't been finalized, but we're hoping that's a good step forward.
Did the Dan River spill speed things up? Did it have an impact on both the public consciousness and political consciousness and also within the power company?
I think definitely. Dan River, you know, got people talking about this issue again. It wasn't long ago that we had an incredibly destructive spill in 2008 in Kingston, Tennessee. And that really got a big national conversation started. But Dan River brought it home to North Carolina and kind of changed the conversation.
You wrote an article, Kemp, in the Fayetteville Observer in June, and you wrote that a Senate bill dealing with coal ash asserted that all coal ash ponds would be closed over the next 15 years, but that doesn't mean they will be cleaned up. So what does closed mean? Nothing is going to be added to it? Is that what that means?
Well, you know, that's a good question. What closed should mean, and the only thing that I think we would accept is that coal ash needs to be dried out, removed from waterways, and put into lined and capped facilities. You can't just put a tarp over a coal ash pond and call it fixed, which is the idea that capping in place suggests.
There must be depleted coal mines in the country that just simply run out of coal to mine. Why can't we put it there?
Well, first and foremost, you're going to you know, send groundwater issues somewhere else, but also a
but
lot I mean,
of... But the coal came from those areas.
Well, the other problem, though, is that you don't necessarily have as many mines anymore. There's been a lot of mountaintop removal, so you're kind of doing it in a different way now. You can't really send it back there.
Okay. You also just transportation is sort of, you know, the cost of that. You know, realistically, this is one of the good environmental problems. In fact, there is an easy solution. I mean, most of these facilities have room or there's room nearby to build a lined landfill and put the coal ash in the landfill. And in Asheville, they're doing it at the airport. They've found a spot and they're doing it, and they're doing a pretty good job of lining it like we'd like to see at the power plant. Unfortunately, they hadn't, you know, done it fully at the power plant yet.
Okay. I think we had a proposal to do that at our airport, and something interfered with it.
Well, they're still looking at possibly doing it. One of the concerns was if it went under the runway, then would that be safe in terms of the shear stress for when planes land on it? And so they're looking at other sites right now around the airport to put it in, you know, possibly put a hangar or some sort of industry on top of it, a simple structural fill.
Okay. One-third of the state's population lives near the Cape Fear River Basin. And on your website, Kemp, you say that you will, and I quote, continue to insist that this river basin is the wrong place for Titan cement and will hold factory farms accountable for the damage they do to the watershed. So let's talk about those things. You have factory farms, which you've already alluded to, along the Cape Fear River Basin. More, this is fascinating to me, more than any other place on Earth.
That's right. Yeah, it's a huge problem for the Cape Fear, and swine farms have been, you know, on the Cape Fear for a long time, and there are more swine farms here than any other place on the planet. The largest slaughterhouse for pigs on the planet is in the Cape Fear River Basin, and what's really worrisome is that now we're seeing a real explosion of poultry farms. So we've already got one of the most impacted watersheds on the planet from animal waste, and now we're adding to it with poultry.
Now, we used to hear a lot of stories about animal waste, particularly mm-hmm. in that part of the state, and suddenly those stories have disappeared. Maybe it's less of a problem. Maybe the media has moved on to the next interest of the day. I don't know. But once again, we're talking about open ponds of water filled with waste sitting on farms. Some of those ponds are lined. Some of them are not.
Most of them are not.
They're earthen dammed ponds.
Right.
The dams can break and do. Talk about the impact.
It's a huge impact. And you know, the ponds you mentioned are the way hog waste is handled. But poultry waste is handled differently. It's what's called a dry litter, and so poultry waste is transported. It's spread on fields. It's spread on fields away from the farm. It's very difficult to track, and it's made almost impossible to track by the fact that...
But isn't natural fertilizer better than artificial fertilizer?
Well, if it's applied at rates that plants can actually use it, but what we find is that fertilizer from CAFOs is applied at rates that are 5 and 10 and more times greater than any plant could ever take up. And so it's left sitting there either on the surface to be picked up by rain and washed into waterways, or it soaks into groundwater and contaminates our aquifers.
The thing is, a lot of this waste does not come at the ideal ratio of nitrogen and phosphorus, which are the two key nutrients for crops to grow from. And so you apply according to one of them, and then you have excess of another. And I went through some public records for the spreading of sludge in South Carolina and found that phosphorus was building up by up to 1,700% in the soil over 4 years. And shockingly, you have phosphorus impairment for the waterways around those fields. And nothing's done because it's, I think, a naive program. And one of the biggest problems we also face is this whole concept of non-discharge permits, to land apply and think that it all gets soaks up and doesn't run off.
When we come back, I want to talk about if that is getting better or whether it's getting worse, because we don't hear as much about it anymore, and if there is a solution that we should know about, and then we'll talk about some other things as well with our three river keepers. On Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Ginger Griffin Marketing and Design, offering marketing and design solutions through logo and brand development, custom websites, and strategic advertising campaigns for over 17 years. President Barack Obama signs the VA reform bill. Republican primaries are held in 5 states. Former White House Press Secretary James Brady dies at 73. Just a couple of the stories that will be discussed this morning on the weekly news roundup, the National Hour at 10, the International Hour at 11 on the Diane Rehm Show, and that gets underway in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation about the health of our waterways in North Carolina, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, Facebook and Twitter will get you to us, and we are coming.
When you attend a WFAE public conversation, your voice can help shape the discussion.
And my fear is that we will settle for mediocrity in order to meet our budgets. And I just want to...
I guess this is a philosophical question for the entire room, which harkens back to the comment that where your passion is, there...
Get connected to past and future public conversations at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Sam Perkins, the Catawba River Keeper. Hartwell Carson is the French Broad River Keeper. And Kemp Burdett comes to us from Wilmington. He's the Cape Fear River Keeper. We were talking just before the break about these factory farms and the effluent stored in their ponds and the disposal of poultry waste, which is stored in a dry fashion and spread across fields for fertilization, but they do it in such a manner that there's more than the plants can possibly use, and so some of it has to go back into the watershed and then therefore into the water supply. And what's going back is commonly referred to as nutrients, which sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about that on the break, and you know, nutrients doesn't sound that bad. You know, it sounds like, oh, it's just the kind of, you know, it's just fertilizer. But what nutrients really do is that they fuel these algal blooms. So we talked briefly at the beginning about the Toledo kind of disaster where 500, 600,000 people lost water due to a microcystin algal bloom. We saw the same thing 3 days later on the Cape Fear above the drinking water intakes for Brunswick County and Wilmington. So
why did we not hear about this?
Well, it was in the paper
down there,
down in Wilmington, and it was obviously a much smaller bloom than what they saw in Toledo, but it was the exact same toxic blue-green algae.
And that comes from too much what in the water? Phosphorus, nitrogen, what?
Too much of both of those and the right conditions, you know, warm water, low flow conditions, and ample nutrients to fuel these kind of explosions of algae. And then what happens is that the algae grows, and then it dies, and when it dies, it uses the oxygen in the water that all of the fish and things in the water need to survive. So you get what you have maybe on the Neuse River, which are, you know, just massive fish kills. I mean, fish kills that go on for miles and miles and miles. Mm. And so, you know, if these fish don't have the oxygen they need, they're going to die.
So we haven't heard a lot about this in recent years. We heard a lot about it for a while. Have things gotten better? Has it just quieted down? And is there a solution to this that you see?
I think on the Cape Fear, our nutrient problem is actually getting worse because of this explosion of poultry. I was at a meeting last night in Fayetteville. There's a new proposed slaughterhouse that would be built right on the Cape Fear River, and that slaughterhouse would spray their wastewater onto spray fields, and what's worse is that it would fuel the expansion of the poultry industry. So we'd see 600 new poultry barns popping up in Cumberland County around Fayetteville, each one of those having, you know, thousands and thousands of chickens producing millions of tons of waste.
Go ahead.
I hate that a lot of times this gets referred to as farming. I mean, it's tough to describe. I think animal factories is the simplest way. This is not what my grandparents did. This is not what a lot of people's families in rural North and South Carolina have done.
This isn't Auntie M going out in the backyard and throwing feed at the chickens.
No, this is not the cute red barn with, you know, six chickens in it. These are major factory operations.
Okay.
Yeah, and so North Carolina, the great thing for poultry is that the state granted them an exemption from public record, and we've seen this come up in a number of issues, but especially in animal factories, they've been exempted from public record.
Meaning what?
Meaning that if you want to get information on where these facilities are, their operations, you can't get them. And so a lot of us have to go up into small airplanes and look for waste problems from the air.
They were granted that exemption. Why? Aside from obvious political pressure, but why would somebody want to do that?
Well, because you don't want to be exposed for your problems, and it did bring the poultry industry here. Poultry houses have exploded. If you go to Google Earth, Google Maps, you can see in the aerial imagery these long silvery houses that have really exploded in the past few years.
And when did this exemption happen?
I forget the exact year. It was relatively recently, though.
Yeah. The other thing is that they're not
– I'm sorry. Who was the governor?
I can't remember exactly who it was.
So I'm trying to determine whether this is a Republican or a Democratic thing, because the Republicans took over the State House several years ago, and people have criticized them for being lenient or more favorable toward industry and business and less so toward citizens. And I'm just trying to – because it could have happened under a Democrat.
More or less, I think it's irrelevant because with both parties, we've seen some good things, but we've also seen a lot of shortcomings in the name of business. It's sort of we need to do this to improve our waterways and our environment and ultimately our infrastructure for providing water to people. And then there's sort of the pushback of, well, it's going to cost businesses money. And I don't think that's necessarily an appropriate counter.
Kemp.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, these poultry houses are not required to have the same types of permits that hog farms are required to have. We had a series of disasters related to hurricanes back in the 90s, and that brought some degree of regulation around hog farms. But right now, poultry farms are what's called deemed permitted. So they do not require permits. I cannot go to the Department of Agriculture and ask for a list showing me where the locations of poultry barns are so that I can get an idea of what parts of my watershed might be at most risk. There is no way for me to know that information. Diener can't even get that information from the Department of Agriculture. These things are very secretive. The way they operate is done in a secretive way, and that's done to minimize the impact that riverkeepers and other groups can have.
What will it take to change that? A disaster?
Unfortunately, that seems to be what frequently gets smart regulation in place. And so we're going to look at, you know, waterways that are completely, that have, you know, not enough oxygen to support fish populations and things like that. And that maybe will push some change. But
We need to continue to refine the Clean Water Act. In 1972, what it dealt with very well was point source discharges. So, you know, your factory, your chemical plant, whatever it was that discharged through a pipe into the river, it did a much better job in dealing with those discharges. What the Clean Water Act has done very poorly is deal with non-point source pollution, like fields, certainly with this program where they're naive to the fact that, you know, if rainwater falls on a field with a bunch of poultry litter just spread on top of it, that rainwater and making its way to a stream is going to pick up some bacteria, some nutrients, some metals. I mean, it's almost naive to the point of thinking that you could run water through pure poultry litter would come out.
Is it naive or is it deliberate? There's a difference between being naive and just allowing it to happen because it's economically expedient.
I think in 1972 you could make an argument that it was maybe not exactly naive, but they just wanted to deal with what they could. And I think we have learned of the shortcomings with the structure of the Clean Water Act.
Let's go back upstate, shall we, to the mountains. See, one of the major pollutants – you don't have this chicken farm, poultry farm problem, but you do have major pollutants in your river, and it's from sediment, I'm told. Much of it is from construction site runoff and illegal roads. I knew nothing about this. But throughout the Pisgah and Cherokee National Forests, people love to ride their all-terrain vehicles, and they create roads by just constant use of these pathways. Why is that a problem for the river?
Well, you know, going back to what Sam said, nobody likes regulation, including any of us here, probably. But also nobody likes having a stream that doesn't meet the goals of the Clean Water Act to be fishable and swimmable. And we've talked a lot about economics. The reality is trout fishing in Western North Carolina is $100+ million industry. So that's a real economic driver that really relies on clean water. And one of the biggest threats to trout fishing in Western North Carolina is sediment. And it doesn't sound very sexy, but it runs off of construction sites and roads often, and it really suffocates the aquatic life that live in the river. And what we found is that the National Forest, although that's somewhere where our most clean water in the state comes from, there are impacts there from folks, you know, taking, you know, making an illegal road that, you know, these huge mud bogs that, that are contributing millions of tons of sediment to a really pristine waterways in the mountains. And so we've been working through the National Forest Foundation to get some grant money to go in, work with the Forest Service and close down a lot of these roads, rehab some of the legal roads, and, you know, bring those trout streams back to what they really should be.
Do the people riding their ATVs through the forests know what they're doing? Do they know the damage they're doing? And if they knew the damage they're doing, would they take would they change their habits?
Yeah, that's a good question. They probably don't. I mean, riding ATVs is incredibly fun, get me wrong.
Absolutely.
So you get carried away. The guy before you makes a road and you fall down that path, and you don't realize that you really are, you know, decimating a really important trout fishery that has huge economic impacts around the state of North Carolina.
Because these are outdoor enthusiasts. I mean, they're ATV enthusiasts, but it would seem to me that they could do that almost anywhere. So they like being outdoors. So they don't want to end that. They don't want to damage that. They're the very people you could talk to who would understand.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think in all of the things we do, education's key. You know, I think the regulations we talked about are important, enforcement's important, but education plays a key role in making sure people understand the impacts of what they're doing and how they can do them differently and you know, not create those impacts.
Let me bring in a couple of emails and things that have come in while we've been talking. Bill from Matthews, could your guests discuss the importance of maintaining and growing our wetland resources for migratory birds? That sounds like a Kemp question unto me, because you have a lot of wetlands down there.
Yeah, and wetlands are critical for so much of the wildlife that lives in all of our watersheds, right? So it's important for birds, it's important for fish, it's important nursery habitat, and you know, so and it's a big economic driver too. When you look at you know, how many people are interested in birding, or how many folks are interested in preserving land to have good hunting, then it's a big, it's incredibly important.
Okay. Robin Morganton, can Sam tell us about the sewage discharge into the Linville River? I got a skin infection bathing in the river in Linville Gorge.
Yeah, unfortunately, especially after rain events, that's when you tend to have a lot of your sewage overflows. It's also kind of when naturally you get a lot of fecal matter into the river just from wildlife. And so generally 24 or 48 hours after a rain event, you should probably not be in the water.
Okay. How often does that happen? Every time it rains?
Every time it rains, you know, it depends on the size of the rain, but that's going to send a lot of stuff naturally in both, you know, from us and our sewer systems into the waterways.
Anybody working to change that?
Absolutely, especially since a lot of the permits are up for renewal in the upcoming year. They're up for renewal every 5 years. That's something that you can work with. Volunteers down at Tiga K were great advocates and got their sewer system transferred to the city, and they're starting to get it cleaned up.
Sue emails, will filtering drinking water from your home tap filter out the harmful pollutants? For instance, use of a Kangen, K-A-N-G-E-N machine.
I'm not sure about that particular machine. I know filters, activated carbon, can remove a lot of metals, a lot of chlorine, and even pharmaceuticals, which is also one of the biggest issues I think we
pharmaceutical
face.
Pharmaceutical pollution, yes.
Pharmaceuticals and also microcystin actually are very difficult to treat for. They make it through drinking water treatment systems. I think people have a tough
time. Do they make it through your refrigerator water filter or your water filter under the sink?
I'd say, given how many pharmaceuticals there are, it depends, and there hasn't been enough research on it.
And the source of those pharmaceuticals in the water is what?
Is waste, as you and me.
Flushing our pills down the toilet when they expire?
Both that and just naturally. We don't take up all of a medicine that we might ingest, and so it passes through our waste and a wastewater treatment plant. I think people think, okay, everything's killed off, destroyed, and it's not.
So when you're talking about these big factory farms where they're also using antibiotics on the livestock, that's getting into the water as well?
Definitely.
Our antibiotics and in poultry in particular, they use an arsenic acid, which has an arsenic molecule in the middle on the chickens. And so that's also a source of arsenic into the water.
Okay. At one point, the French Broad watershed was home to more than 30 inactive hazardous waste sites, which may or may not have been polluting groundwater, surface water, drinking water, etc. Have you been working to determine just how much of a hazard these sites may actually be posing?
Yeah, we've started a little bit. It's kind of a big task. There was a site called the CTS site in Asheville that's gotten fairly famous in that it was an inactive site. It was determined to be polluting dozens and dozens of people's drinking water with, you know, really bad contamination, trichlor ethylene, stuff that really makes people sick. And it was also it also kind of showed the failure of the regulatory system. I mean, this was first brought to the attention of the state and the EPA in the 90s. And here we are in 2014, and this neighborhood's still trying to get this place cleaned up.
Well, I think, Kemp, you used some examples about drinking water problems around the country in an article that you wrote recently, I think in February, as a way to talk about actions being taken in the General Assembly to weaken environmental regulation. Still going on?
Yes, that went on throughout the session. I think there's still some discussion about how the short session is going to wrap up, but there have been repeated attempts to weaken environmental regulation from our General Assembly.
So successful attempts.
If we only have a couple of seconds left, what do the three of you want to see change the most or the soonest, and what can people listening do to help you in those efforts?
You know, nothing happens unless people demand it, and people demanded action on coal ash, and our state has failed us, and Duke Energy's failed us. They attempted to pass a very weak coal ash bill, and were unsuccessful doing that. I would, you know, if the citizens across the state of North Carolina demand action and real action to really clean this issue up on coal ash, I think we'll see that happen.
I hope that we'll start to see some accountability held, that people will contact their legislators directly and let them know that the environment is a priority, because it's not just the environment. It's the economy. It's property tax revenue. It's recreation. It's a lot of intangibles also. But there is a lot of green in going green.
Yeah, and I would just say, you know, I hope people recognize how bad of a decision this has been to try to attack every environmental law out there. I mean, both nationally and in North Carolina, we're seeing that the chickens are coming home to roost now with these spills, with you know, waterways that are dying, with, you know, chemical spills in West Virginia. We need to have tough environmental regulation.
Are you worried, only have 10 seconds, are you worried about the impact fracking might have?
I'm very worried. I think all of us are pretty worried about fracking.
Okay, that's Kemp Burdett, Cape Fear Riverkeeper, Hartwell Carson with us, the French Broad Riverkeeper, and Sam Perkins, our own Catawba Riverkeeper. Thank you for coming up here from Wilmington and from coming down here from Asheville, and thank you for walking across the street, Sam.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production.